The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of the brutal murder of two girls, as well as the topic of child sexual abuse materials. Listener discretion is advised.
The unsolved murders of Liberty German and Abigail Williams have attracted a great deal of interest on the internet. There's a sprawling online community devoted to the case and to seeking justice for Libby and Abby. Much of the content they produce is informative and well-intentioned. Some of it isn't. But that community is one that we've become a part of just by doing journalism on this case.
The person we'll be speaking to in today's episode is also a part of this community. We previously released an episode in our ongoing mini-series, You Never Can Forget, about the Burger Chef murders, featuring a commenter we called Hank. That was a great opportunity to speak about a complex case with a knowledgeable researcher, and we thought we'd do something similar with this episode.
So we decided to reach out to Tony Garner. Tony is someone who's been following this case for quite a while. He's a tremendously talented researcher, and we respect his well-thought-out opinions and his grasp of this complicated case. We were thrilled when he agreed to sit down with us and talk through some of the latest developments.
We'll be discussing everything from Tony and Kegan Klein, the father and son duo whose sources tell us are the focus of the current Delphi investigation, to Nicole Robertson, the FBI agent who wrote up the probable cause affidavit for Ron Logan's property. My name is Anya Kane.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee.
And this is The Murder Sheet, a weekly true crime podcast.
Anya and I connected over the Burger Chef murders, a 1978 unsolved case involving the killings of four young restaurant employees.
Now we're looking to track restaurant homicides. To help us understand the patterns of these crimes, we created a spreadsheet of nearly 1,000 eatery-related killings, the Murder Sheet. We'll be drawing on that data throughout Season 1 to give you a deep dive into undercovered crimes.
We're The Murder Sheet.
And this is The Delphi Murders, a conversation with Tony Garner.
Thank you.
I wasn't like a web sleuth or an armchair detective. I didn't really follow a lot of true crime or anything like that. But what happened to Libby and Abby really grabbed me. I think if this crime just happened in the woods somewhere, and if Libby hadn't captured the images of her killer, it might not have captivated me so much. The images of the bridge seemed almost like mythological, crossing this bridge almost literally from life to death. The images of this man, and I've showed this pictures to friends of mine, they said, oh, it's a guy in a blue coat. But when I look at it, it's like a snapshot out of hell. It's like a photo of pure evil. And it seems like the longer this case goes on being unresolved, the more you're pulled in and the more you obsess about it and think about it. So back in the beginning, I didn't feel like there was much information in the media. I felt a lot of the statements from law enforcement were confusing and vague. So eventually I ended up where I think everyone else did, looking around the social media platforms. And I got a lot more information there. It wasn't always great information. But I'll say this. So when Murder Sheet started covering the Delphi murders, I was just really drawn to the professionality, the great interviews. And that's when I reached out to you guys, and we began talking about Delphi.
And we're very, very glad you did reach out to us, Tony, because we really appreciate your insights. I think out of the many, many people we talked to about this case, you know this case perhaps the best. I feel like we can go to you with any detail, and you're going to be able to kind of put it together and come up with some really interesting insights. So we're really delighted that you joined us today, and we appreciate that. I guess, you know, I think we can maybe kick it off perhaps by sort of having a discussion with one another about something that we recently published, which was the probable cause affidavit and search warrant for Ron Logan. This has gotten some attention recently, and it all kind of comes down to ultimately this report written by an FBI agent, Nicole Robertson. And there's obviously been a lot of discussion about Ron Logan himself, but I think one thing that we've spoken about is Nicole Robertson's involvement in this case and what that possibly speaks to. I guess, could we get your thoughts on that?
Yes. Nicole Robertson is an FBI agent that at the time was out of Chicago. So she's not from Indianapolis. She's not from Lafayette. Certainly not from Delphi. So Chicago's a little bit away. So why was she the agent writing this probable cause affidavit? It turns out that, to the best of my information, Nicole Robertson specialized in sex trafficking of minors. And if you think about the tips that had come in about Ron Logan and the information that law enforcement was acting upon, such as the false alibi, people saying that he resembled the man on the bridge, his proximity to the crime in his residence, that none of that would bring in Nicole Robertson from Chicago to research this.
Yeah, very well said. I think that the inclusion of somebody who essentially seems like a specialist in a certain topic indicates that authorities at some point very early on in the investigation felt very strongly that the clues and the evidence was pointing in a specific direction.
Is that how you see it, Tony?
Yes. And I think that the reason that Nicole Robertson is on the case researching Ron Logan is because of what happened a month previous in the Klein raid. So the timeline's important here, in my opinion. They raid the Kleins, what, a week, 10 days after the murders? And they find all types of child solicitation and pornography on multiple devices. So to me, they're looking for a connection to that when they're going in to search Ron Logan's property.
So that's really interesting. And I wonder, and of course we're speculating here, right? None of this conversation or this portion of the conversation is not based on what a source told us. It's all of us putting together the known facts and coming up with plausible explanations. One thing that stands out to me, though, is the possibility that Nicole Robertson, the FBI, the ISP, is possibly looking for a connection, actually, between Logan and the Kleins by dint of them looking for these items that speak to a possible ring of child predators, essentially.
Yes, I think that's totally the case. And more specifically, in the probable cause affidavit, there's a laundry list of computer and photographic type devices that they're looking for. And that stuff, again, makes more sense being somehow connected to what they found in Peru at the Klein residence than it necessarily would be from things they found at the scene of the crime and were linking to a 77-year-old man.
Right. What do you make of the fact that seemingly police have not or did not find anything when they did indeed raid Ron Logan's house in March of 2017? And I say that because he was never arrested. He was never charged with the crime. He was never even named as a person of interest or a suspect by police. So it feels like on some level, the outward indicators are that, you know, Logan ended up not being linked to it. What are your thoughts, though?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think it says that he didn't do it. I think that it speaks strongly that he was suspicioned, or maybe they were suspicious that he was, again, in contact with someone who used his property to commit the crime. And they were trying to find some type of digital footprint, DNA, some traces of that person in that Logan property.
You've been looking into this case for longer than we have. And one thing that I wanted to get your take on is, you know, a lot of people have said, well, Ron Logan looks like the person on the bridge. Do you think that there is an over-reliance on the sketches or the image of the man crossing the bridge when it comes to the public discourse around Delphi? Because it feels like people very much get hung up on those things pretty frequently, in my opinion, at least.
Well, people are going to vary widely about the images of the man on the bridge. People say it looks like a hat, and people say it looks like hair, and I did not get the hair. I've never understood why people thought it looked like that, but I think you get a lot of, disagreement about it. And it's obviously not a clear image. As far as the sketches go, we don't even know why there are two sketches. And we've seen people feel like both of those sketches resemble all kinds of different looking and appearing people. So how much the sketch is actually helping at this point, I don't think it is.
To jump forward a bit, we released back in March the transcript of the police interrogation of Kagan Klein, and a number of people have pointed out that it seems pretty clear that there's Kagan is not entirely truthful in that interrogation, that he told a number of lies. Did you have any insights or thoughts about that?
Yes, I think that, Kagan Klein really implicates himself as having some knowledge of the crime because of the numerous lies that he tells. Someone who did not have anything to hide would have no reason to get caught up in all the confabulations that he does in that transcript.
What do you think his reason to lie might have been?
I think he's protecting someone. And he's protecting that person because he himself is possibly implicated.
It's very interesting. Another thing that's mentioned in that interrogation is they point out some of the things that Kagan had been doing research on online and Googling things. Was there anything about that that caught your attention?
I think that some of the questions about how long does DNA last, looking for information about Abby and Libby, was clear that he was wanting to see what the media and law enforcement were saying about the crime. One point I would say that I believe the total number of times that he plays back the Down the Hill recording when it's first released is like 6 times. I don't think that's a big excessive number. I remember the first time I heard it, I couldn't understand what was being said. So I can see somebody playing it back 6 times just out of curiosity or trying to hear it better.
That could be a concerned citizen who's trying to commit the voice to memory to, you know, see if they ever hear it again, that they'll be able to recognize it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I agree that some of the Kagan Klein's internet searches could have been somebody who was just interested in the case. Although that theory kind of gets blown out of the water a little bit, given that he's then in the same interview asserting, you know, I had no idea about this. I had no interest in the case. He seemed to research it pretty extensively for somebody who claimed not to be super aware of it.
I would agree.
And that's the kind of weird thing about the Kagan Klein interview, is that he's kind of he's lying when he's obviously caught dead to rights. You feel like it would have been simpler to perhaps just say, yeah, I was interested in it, so was everybody.
Or, because he knows that he talked to her the day of the murders, he could simply just say, you know, I had talked to her that day, and I was really nervous about this.
Right. He strikes me as the kind of person who is lying a lot without necessarily being particularly good at it. A good liar tends to pick their battles. He seems like a person who is perhaps just not challenged a lot on his obvious lies in life, and then, you know, kind of just went with that strategy going forward.
What's more fun than living out your own cozy mystery?
You know, Kevin and I love to explore real life mysteries. Well, sometimes it's a nice break to get immersed in a fictional mystery story. And playing the free-to-download hidden object game June's Journey is just like starring in your own caper.
This game is a great way to sharpen your observational skills and encourage yourself to take quick, re-energizing breaks throughout the day. You play as June Parker, a flapper / sleuth, who navigates Jazz Age mysteries with aplomb.
In between levels, you can also build up your own fancy island estate. And you know I'm all about that. You can plant flowers, float on swan ponds, and even set loose a beautiful horse. It's very fun.
We enjoy playing this game when we're waiting around for a source to call us back, or when we're stuck outside waiting for a courthouse to open up. It's great fun.
Discover your inner detective when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have?
or the friends you find along the way. Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
So I was thinking one we could... go ahead, please.
One thing I wanted to say about Ron Logan in his defense is that from what we know about this crime, a lot of planning went into it. In terms of the killer had what he needed to accomplish what he did. He evidently had knowledge of cleaning up the crime scene, and it's even stated in the probable cause affidavit that they were looking for information on electronic devices where the individual had searched for how to destroy a crime scene. So that's very meticulous. So if a guy is going to do this and not have a good alibi, that doesn't make any sense. And what Ron Logan comes up with for alibi is ridiculous and gets him into even more trouble. You would think if you were planning this crime to the extent that it was planned, you would have an alibi, a pretty good plan for one.
Yes, and that the call with his relative who drove him to the aquarium store in Lafayette, that call would be happening prior to the crime, almost, you know, if it was going to be planned, and not the day of when you're scrambling, essentially. It looks like more of a man panicking to me than somebody who is calculating enough to pull this off.
I agree.
What did you make about all the kind of confusion around, you know, he's going to the dump earlier and then later on he's also driving, but he's only making the alibi for that and not the morning driving session?
My guess would be that he probably had some provisions that he could go to the doctor, to the transfer station, things like that. And that would not have been what was going to get him into trouble.
His initial alibi that afternoon didn't even include the time of the abduction, essentially, because from the video we can understand that they were abducted, say about around a little after 2:10. Yeah, right. I think that I may have gotten that from you initially, Tony. I think maybe Kevin thought of that, and it really kind of made me think about the affidavit differently, because I was like, if you were going to give an alibi, why aren't you covering 2 p.m. at the very, you know, latest? Instead, he's covering 3 p.m. onward. I think he later amended that to 2:30 p.m. But still, it's kind of like you would think somebody who is really trying to conceal their role in the abduction would, you know, just go for broke and perhaps say 1 p.m. onward or whatnot, but he didn't seem to be able to do that. And to me, that sloppiness kind of goes with what you're saying about why was his alibi so bad.
Correct.
I think for Kevin and I, at least, the Logan affidavit and search warrant were more interesting in what they tell us about what the investigators were looking for, because that gives us an idea of what the crime looked like, essentially. Because investigators, is a month after the murders, they're running this down, they're looking for specific things. And some of that was some of the technological devices that they're looking for. But another thing that I think stood out to all of us in this report is, you know, things like forensic evidence. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that or anything around the forensic evidence that they were looking for that really stood out to you.
Well, I think the clothing items that were missing speak to the depravity of the crime. That this was almost certainly a crime driven, at least in part, as a, of sexual nature, or was an attempt to make it look like that was the motive of the crime.
There's also a reference in the affidavit to guns. What did you make of that?
I believe a gun was used in the crime in some way. Whether they found a ballistic, whether a gun was used as a blunt force instrument, I think it was used in some way other than just in an attempt to control them. Because what evidence would there be at the crime scene that would make you look for a gun or a specific gun?
Yeah, it's like if we could speculate for a second, if the man was audibly saying, "I have a gun," or the girls were talking about the gun in the recording that Libby took, you know, that wouldn't identify anything. They wouldn't be able to look for anything specifically in their search. So it really does make you wonder about how that might have manifested itself or what clues they were going off of, essentially.
Well, I guess, though, let's suppose that they do hear, they say the click of a revolver in the audio, or he says, you know, "I've got a gun." I guess it's possible that he would have got their blood on the gun, even if he didn't use it.
Right. So kind of maybe more of a forensic wrap up as opposed to we have bullets, essentially.
Sure.
Over the years since this crime happened, there's really been a very vigorous online community that has developed around this case. And you've been a part of it. I just wonder if you had any comments or insights about that community.
Well, I believe that, you know, some of the online communities are better than others. And I think that there is a lot of bogus information introduced in many of these communities, these Facebook groups and things like that. But I think there has been some legitimate research done in these groups as well.
I'm curious, what advice would you give to people listening as to how to separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to this, the online community and the information they share?
I would start by taking notes, keeping track of the things you're seeing that seem to make sense, because you can very quickly accumulate folders on your computer that have all kinds of different things in it. Or you may feel the need to go back and look at something or reread something, and you just don't have it or you can't find it. So I would say, you know, to keep track of things that you find interesting. And I think you'll see which people are more genuine about their opinions and their research in these types of groups and on YouTube and social media. And then you'll see people that, you know, obviously believe just about anything.
This case seems to have attracted the attention of people literally all over the world. What do you suppose it is about this case that has touched the hearts of so many?
I think I would just go back to what I said earlier about the archetypal quality of the story. It's almost like a Grimm Brothers fairy tale. And when I say archetypal, this is a term out of Jungian psychology, which refers to how certain motifs appear across different cultures and their similar stories. And it just sort of, the big stories stick, you know, around for centuries. And this whole image of this crime, if you look at, you know, two young women going out into the wilderness, crossing a bridge, this boogeyman, you know, that confronts them, you know, that imagery, you know, it's not just here because it's in Indiana. It is worldwide. I was really surprised when Carter mentioned that he gets tips on a weekly basis from around the world.
You mentioned us, ISP Superintendent Doug Carter, and, you know, obviously the three of us are working from the outside of this investigation. We're not law enforcement, so we're not privy to a lot of those decisions and whatnot that they're making. Kevin and I have been critical about some of the communication strategies that we feel that ISP in particular has employed around this case. We feel like it's kind of created an informational vacuum where speculation abounds. But I guess I would love to get your take, because you've been with this case for longer than we have. What's been your perception over time about how police are doing? And, you know, have any of the recent revelations about the Logan documents or the Klein documents, you know, changed the way you think about it?
Well, I would totally agree that there is not enough information fluidly coming out of ISP about this case. There have been lots of questions about things that have been stated from law enforcement that are just not even clarified.
Yeah, I definitely don't understand that in particular, because it feels like that can really create uncertainty.
Why do you suppose they don't clarify those things?
I don't know why they don't clarify these things. I would think just a simple press secretary could do something like that. I understand that their philosophy is very rigid about keeping their cards close to the vest. But I think after such a great period of time, you have to consider changing strategy. And they've done that a little bit, but could more information be released? I'm a believer in that.
We are too. And I think after 5 years, I think it's reasonable for other entities in the media or whatnot to focus on police response to this crime. And, you know, there needs to be perhaps some oversight of how they're doing. And I feel like a lot of their messaging almost tends to be like, we'll tell you all about this eventually. With a case that's 5 years old, I think it's reasonable to say, well, when is that coming exactly? Asking some of those tough questions about, like, is this on track to be solved? And if not, then what's happened?
I would agree.
So just backtracking a little bit, I want to go back to the Logan document. One thing that really stood out to us, Tony, was just the fact that it mentions cellular signals that were detected by law enforcement that seemingly, at least as of March 2017, they hadn't been able to track down. And I guess for you, what sort of picture does that paint of the crime?
The question I have is how many devices were in that area of the crime that they never were able to identify? In the Robert Ives interviews, he's talked about that they were unable to glean any data from the devices that were in that area. And it seems like he's saying multiple. And I think if there is one device, one phone, then that tells us something. And if there's two or three or four, that also tells us something.
I have to add that I think that the fact that they haven't been able to track down those phones could tell us something. In that if somebody was employing a burner phone or burner phones in this crime, that to me speaks to a level of planning that I think is important to note, because that sort of changes how this looks to me. Like, it's not some sort of confrontation gone wrong. It's becoming much more like people or one person went there to do something specifically.
Yeah, I would interpret it that way.
What are some of the biggest misconceptions you believe people have about this case?
There have been numerous syndicated shows talking about Ron Logan since Murder Sheet released the Ron Logan documents. And I think that many of these newscasters and journalists have maybe focused too much on Ron Logan, who aren't really familiar with the case and haven't really followed it. So I think that's one mistake that people are making. Another, I think the idea that the bodies were moved is a misconception in terms of moved any great distance. A lot of people have believed that they were moved because searchers had gone through that area on the 13th. And I just think there's a lot of reasons why the searchers might have missed them, you know, on the 13th. It could have been that it was dark. It could have been they were looking for living girls. It could have been the gulchiness of the land hiding them. It would have been very difficult for someone to come back in the middle of the night and enter an area with a huge police presence and a massive search underway for these girls and to return their bodies.
I agree on both counts. Going back to the first, as a journalist, I think there can sometimes be an unconscious bias in the media to go for the easiest narrative. And when you have images of a very blurry person on the bridge that look somewhat, in fairness, like Ron Logan, I think there's a rush to say, well, that's the easy solution, as opposed to, you know, ask harder questions, because you're dealing with time and space and a rush to get the news out. And I think then, you know, that can prompt certain narratives to form when perhaps a more judicious approach is necessary to a case like this. And it seems important to point out that Ron Logan has not been tied to a social media account that was in contact with one of the victims right before her murder. That being the Anthony Schatz account, that being the Klein household, Kegan Klein and his father, Tony Klein. That's the house where that's coming out of. So we always try to stress that people should focus on the timeline and what was happening in 2020 versus what was happening in 2017. Things start to look a little bit more clear, and that the focus remains on the Kleins.
I would agree.
I'm curious, we talked about misconceptions that get too much attention. Are there details out there that you think don't get as much attention as they deserve to get, that people are just overlooking?
I think what we have now between the Logan's search documents and the transcripts with Kegan Klein, we see a common theme here that they were looking in 2017 for a connection to some type of pornography or child sex trafficking of some nature, and that being behind some aspect of this crime.
I'm curious, what do you think would be needed to bring this case to a resolution?
It seems that outside of a confession or a direct tip from someone who knows the killer, that the evidence is lacking at this point. Well, one idea would be that there could be advances in technology that would allow law enforcement to reanalyze the social media platforms that Abby and Libby were on in 2017. I find it very interesting that in 2017, they search the home of Kegan Klein and find all this information, but it's not until 2021 where the discussion goes public about the Anthony Schatz account. It seems that there was some change in technology that allowed them to find this information.
Yeah, I think we're hopeful about something like that too. Or, you know, I think, but it also kind of, to circle back to something we were talking about earlier, it sort of really poses the question of why some of this information wasn't released earlier, because 5 years is a long time, especially if there's possible, you know, people who are on some of these platforms interacting with Anthony Schatz, might have been better for them to perhaps be alerted to the possibility that that account was a suspect earlier on, so they could, you know, realize that and immediately go to police while this was fresh in their minds.
It's a great point. We don't really know when they actually found the connection between Anthony Schatz and Liberty German.
We wanted to thank Tony Garner for sharing his time and insights with us. We very much appreciate it.
And as always, if you have information on this case, email abbyandlibbytip@cacoshrf.com or call the tip line, which is 765-822-3535. And if you have information about the Kleins that you want to pass on to us, email murdersheet@gmail.com. We protect our sources. To our surprise, we've gotten a number of requests from people saying they would like a way to help financially support our efforts with the show. So, if you are interested, we are relaunching a Patreon page which you can find at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. Join us there for 2 live video question and answer sessions each month. You can ask us anything, suggest new cases for us to look at, or even offer ideas for new leads for us to follow. If Patreon is not your thing, you can buy us a coffee at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. Thanks for the interest.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Murder Sheet. As always, thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
To keep up with the latest on The Murder Sheet, please make sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Murder Sheet, and on Facebook at MSheet Podcast, or by searching Murder Sheet. If you enjoy listening to The Murder Sheet, please leave us a 5-star review to help us gain more exposure. And send tips, suggestions, and feedback to murdersheet@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.